The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Mario Ritter Jr., and Katie Weaver. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
A German restaurant forced to close because of the coronavirus crisis is now helping needy people in Berlin. Hofbräu Berlin is the capital's largest restaurant and beer place. But it remains closed to the public because of restrictions aimed at reducing spread of the coronavirus. One employee, however, proposed that the restaurant could partly reopen to help the city's homeless. Hofbräu Berlin began taking in homeless people last week, providing them with a free meal and a place to warm themselves. The city government is financing the program for operation through the winter. The restaurant accepts 150 homeless people at a time, but enforces social distancing requirements to help prevent new infections. During normal times, Hofbräu Berlin holds up to 3,000 visitors. Björn Schwartz runs the restaurant. He told the Associated Press the project is a win-win, meaning helpful to all involved. The homeless find food and shelter during a difficult time. The restaurant and employees make some money. Normally, during Christmas time, we would have many groups here for Christmas parties, and then we'd serve pork knuckles or half a duck or goose, Schwartz said. But not at the moment. The homeless get more than just food and drink at the restaurant. They can also use its restrooms for washing themselves. And two aid groups supply counseling services and new clothes at the restaurant as well. Schwartz said his team aims to provide the visitors with a different experience than they would get at homeless shelters. For example, Hofbräu Berlin serves the food on nice plates and tries to offer many different food choices, including Christmas dishes. One visitor is 43-year-old Kaspers Breidachs. He told the AP he came to Germany from Latvia 3 months ago looking for work. None could be found. He now lives on the streets of Berlin, asking strangers for money. Breidachs said he is trying to get enough money to buy a bus trip home to Latvia. He stays in shelters for the homeless when possible, but says they have been operating at reduced levels because of the coronavirus. He learned about the restaurant project from some homeless people at the train station. Berlin has an estimated street population of 2,000 to 12,000. The government says another 34,000 homeless people have been placed in community shelters and other housing run by social services and aid groups. The coronavirus pandemic has seriously worsened the situation for homeless people. They live in very precarious conditions, said Elke Breitenbach. She is the Berlin government's senator for social issues. She supports the restaurant-turned-shelter. They don't have enough to eat, and when it's cold, they must have places to warm up, Breitenbach added. Breidachs and other homeless people entering the restaurant were offered several food choices that included traditional German favorites. Breidachs said it was more than he had expected after spending a night outside in the extreme cold. All I need is hot soup, he said. And, God willing, I will go back home in January. I'm Brian Lynn.
Before the start of the Lunar New Year in January, Chinese officials reported an outbreak of a lung infection from a market in the city of Wuhan. There were about 41 cases of infection and one death linked to an unknown coronavirus at the time. Some thought it was similar to the SARS virus, short for Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome. That virus struck southern China in late 2002. It then spread to more than 24 countries, killing nearly 800 people. Others compared the new virus to MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. That coronavirus was first reported in 2012, in Saudi Arabia, before spreading to 27 countries and leading to 858 known deaths. The SARS and MERS outbreaks were mainly contained, but there are still no vaccines for those diseases.
Vaccine development is a long and complex process. It took 18 years for scientists to successfully develop a vaccine against polio, a disease that paralyzed many children. The College of Physicians of Philadelphia said it took 2 to 4 years just to identify a substance in the lab that could fight a disease. But this outbreak was different. In just 2 months, the new coronavirus had infected more than 118,000 people in 114 countries. More than 4,200 had died from the disease. The World Health Organization declared the new coronavirus a pandemic on March 11th. Around the world, scientists immediately went to work to develop a vaccine based on the genetic structure of the new coronavirus, published on Virological.com. The WHO says there are currently more than 50 COVID-19 vaccine candidates undergoing human trials. At least 12 of the trials are in the Phase 3 level, with as many as 40,000 volunteers. This month, the United States, Britain, and the European Union approved the first two vaccines developed by Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna for emergency use against the new coronavirus. The approval came less than a year since the start of the pandemic. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration found the two vaccines from Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna to be safe and 95% effective against COVID-19. The rate is well above the requirement that a vaccine be at least 50% effective to be considered for emergency use. Dr. Anthony Fauci is the U.S. government's top infectious diseases expert. He said, "Not very many people expected it would be as high as that."
American drug maker Pfizer is one of the largest companies in the world. Moderna is a small biotech company that has not brought any product to the market. But the two drug makers have one thing in common. They both used a technology called messenger RNA, or mRNA, to develop the vaccines in record time. Traditional vaccines usually inject an inactive or weakened virus into the body to force the production of antibodies to fight the virus. The vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna do not contain the coronavirus itself. The mRNA vaccines give instructions for our cells to make what is called the spike protein, a substance found on the surface of the virus that causes COVID-19. The cell then breaks down the instructions and gets rid of them. The human body recognizes that the protein does not belong there and starts producing antibodies to fight against COVID-19. At the end of the process, the body learns how to protect against future infection. The benefit of mRNA vaccines is that those who are vaccinated gain protection without having the risk of getting sick with COVID-19.
No mRNA vaccine has been approved to treat people until now. But research on the technology started nearly 30 years ago. In 1990, University of Pennsylvania scientist Kathleen Carrico proposed using mRNA technology in gene therapy. At the time, the technology was difficult to work with. When she injected lab mice with the genetic material, some died. Carrico worked with colleague Drew Weissman. They made an important discovery in 2005. They replaced one of mRNA's four chemical building blocks with a slightly modified substance called pseudouridine. Weissman said, "We submitted that for a patent, and that was the birth of therapeutic RNA." Carrico and Weissman's findings, however, did not receive much attention until 2010. That year, Harvard University scientist Derek Rossi used modified mRNA in his StealthSEM research. Rossi, along with several others, licensed the technology to establish a new biotech drug maker called Moderna. The name is a combination of the words modified and RNA. Carrico now works for BioNTech, supervising development of its mRNA product. On December 8th, Margaret Keenan of Britain became the first person in the world to receive a tested and approved COVID-19 vaccine made by Pfizer-BioNTech. Keenan, who was to turn 91 the following week, said, "It's the best early birthday present I could wish for, because it means I can finally look forward to spending time with my family and friends in the new year, after being on my own for most of the year. Around the world, about 74 million people have been infected with the new coronavirus. Nearly 1.7 million have died from COVID-19. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. 1892 was a presidential election year in the United States. In that year, most parts of the American economy were expanding. But one part was not doing well: agriculture. The result was the birth of a new political party. It was called the People's Party. Its members were called populists. Stan Busby and Morris Joyce tell about the populists and how they campaigned against the Republicans and Democrats in the election.
In the late 1880s, a North Carolina farming publication described America's economy this way: "There is something radically wrong in our industrial system. The railroads are making much money, yet agriculture is failing. The banks are doing great business, yet agriculture is failing. Towns and cities grow, yet agriculture is failing. Wages were never so high, yet agriculture is failing." Historians give four major reasons why agriculture was failing in the late 1880s. One was the high cost of transportation. Second was high taxes. Third was falling prices for agricultural products. And fourth was the high cost of borrowing money.
Farmers began to organize to discuss their problems. They formed local groups called alliances. An alliance member described the result of these discussions: "People began to think who had never thought before. People talked who had never spoken much. Little by little, they began to study their condition. They discussed taxes on income, government ownership of property, the unity of labor, and a thousand other opposing ideas."
Local alliances formed larger groups. The larger groups included many persons who were not farmers, but who lived and worked in agricultural areas. These included teachers, doctors, repairmen, reporters, and church leaders. In 1889, the major alliances held separate conventions in St. Louis, Missouri. They refused to form one big alliance. They were divided on several important issues.
The chief issue was political. leaders of the Northern Alliance had decided that agricultural interests could expect little help from either the Republican or Democratic parties. They believed the answer to their problems was a third national political party. Leaders of the Southern Alliance disagreed. They belonged to the Democratic Party. And at that time, Democrats faced little opposition in the South. A new party would weaken their political power. So they wanted to work for change within the existing Democratic Party.
Another issue dividing the Northern and Southern alliances was racial. How would a united alliance deal with black farmers? The Southern Alliance did not permit black members, and it did not want blacks in a united alliance. The Northern Alliance said blacks could join. The two groups could not settle their differences before the state and congressional elections of 1890. So they did not campaign as one party, but they campaigned for one idea: help for America's farmers. Throughout the South and Middle West, they succeeded in electing agricultural candidates as governors, state legislators, senators, and members of the House of Representatives.
Farm leaders everywhere were surprised by their election victories in 1890. They had not expected to win so much so quickly. Leaders of the Northern Alliance decided the time was right to form one party to represent all farmers. They felt sure of success. For now, enough leaders of the Southern Alliance were willing to support the idea. These Southern leaders had succeeded within the Democratic Party, but they quickly learned that they held political power only at the local level. They held almost no power at the national level. So, a few months before the presidential election of 1892, America's agricultural alliances held a joint convention in Omaha, Nebraska. They formed a new party. They called it the People's Party. They called themselves populists.
Delegates to the convention approved a policy statement for the new party. The statement said the national government should own the country's railroads, telegraph, and telephone systems. It said the government, not banks, should supply paper money. And it said no limits should be put on government production of silver money. The populists called for a tax on earnings, fewer working hours for labor, controls on immigration. To help farmers, the populists demanded what they called the sub-treasury plan. Under this plan, farmers could put their crops in government storehouses. Then they could wait to sell the crops until prices rose. While they waited, they could borrow money from the government at low cost. They would pay back the loans when they sold their crops.
The new People's Party also proposed ways to make government more democratic. It said secret ballots should be used in all elections. It said senators should be elected by the people, not chosen by state legislatures. Most Americans considered populist proposals extreme. They felt the proposals were too close to socialism or communism. The populists considered their proposals just. They felt their movement was a struggle for more equal control of the nation. On one side of the struggle were producers. These included farmers, laborers, and small businessmen. They were led by the New People's Party. On the other side were what populists called non-producers. These included wealthy bankers and leaders of industry. They were led by the Republican and Democratic parties. Populists wanted producers to have some of the political power traditionally held by non-producers. They wanted producers to get a fairer share of the nation's increasing wealth.
The People's Party chose James Weaver as its candidate in the presidential election of 1892. Weaver had been an officer in the Union Army during America's Civil War. He had served in the House of Representatives, and he had been the candidate of a minor party in the presidential election of 1880. The Republican Party renominated President Benjamin Harrison, and the Democratic Party nominated former President Grover Cleveland.
The campaign began quietly, but a few months before the election, a labor dispute exploded into an important campaign issue. Several thousand steel workers went on strike at a factory owned by the Carnegie Steel Company in Homestead, Pennsylvania. The steel workers' union called the strike after failing to reach a wage agreement with company officials. After months of growing tension, the head of the company sent 300 private security officers to break up the strike and protect non-union workers. The security officers and many of the strikers carried guns. Shots were fired. 10 men were killed. The governor of Pennsylvania immediately sent state soldiers to the steel factory. After a few more attempts to continue the strike, the union admitted defeat. Its power was crushed. It would be more than 40 years before America's steelworkers were organized again.
A short time later, state soldiers were used to break up a strike by railroad workers in New York, and federal soldiers were used against striking silver miners in Idaho. This use of government troops to end strikes caused many citizens to vote against the ruling Republican Party. They voted for the opposition Democratic or People's Parties instead. In the election of 1892, Republican President Benjamin Harrison was defeated. Democrat Grover Cleveland, who had lost to Harrison 4 years earlier, would be president again. The People's Party candidate, James Weaver, won 1 million popular votes and 22 electoral votes.
Grover Cleveland returned to the White House, just as his wife had said he would. But his second administration would be much more difficult than his first. Within 2 months of Cleveland's inauguration, the United States entered into one of the worst economic depressions in its history.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.